This week on Making Contact.
The debts of the Third World came to be what they are through a process of aggressive loan marketing in the 1970s. That was probably the most influential part of this. The World Bank and private banks both in the 1970s were looking to lend.
People who are not responsible of the debt should not be paying for it. The peasant should not be paying for it. The child should not, who's just newborn, should not be paying for it by not having enough milk, not having clothing, you know, health, primary health care, on that. They were never consulted.
Heads of state, rock stars, activists, and many others have called for debt relief for heavily indebted poor countries of the Global South. On this archive edition of Making Contact, we take a look at international debt, its causes, and why some are calling for the debts to be canceled. I'm Philip Babbage, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. According to some estimates, debt owed by countries in Latin America and Africa total over $350 billion. Other estimates, which include countries such as Haiti, and factor in the long-term effects of debt, put the total much higher. Mozambique, for instance, spends 33% of its budget on debt, much more than the 8% it spends on education and the 3% it spends on health. On average, countries in sub-Saharan Africa pay four times as much on debt servicing than they do on health care. Joke Jeho, director of the 50 Years is Enough U.S. Network for Global Economic Justice, says that in order to service its international debt, her home country, Kenya, grows cotton and coffee to export rather than basic foods to feed its people.
It manifests itself in many, many ways. I can give you two examples, one of which is the last time I was in Kenya, which was in 97, a story in the leading English daily, the president calling for food aid from the international community because young children and old people were dying in eastern province of Kenya because there was a drought and there was no food. But also in that same paper, the same edition, same day paper, there was a story of farmers complaining and decrying the fact that they had planted, harvested cotton, and it was now sitting in warehouses rotting because they did not have the means to transport it to the port and to the airport so that it could be exported to Europe. And at the same time that that this was happening, of course, you had this the children and old people starving to death. And it's an irony of a country that cannot feed and protect its youngest and its weakest, but that continues to produce for export non-edible cash crops. And I think that the answer really perhaps should be as easy as Kenya growing rice and beans and millet and sorghum and cassava and sweet potatoes and yams so that the youngest and the weakest do not starve to death, instead of having farmers growing cotton and coffee and tea and tobacco to serve, so that we can earn foreign currency to service our debt.
There is an estimated loan amount, an outstanding loan amount of $380 on every man, woman, and child in Africa. Every child that is born in Africa has a loan amount of $380 that must be paid.
Nunu Kadani is an Eritrean national who is the Africa Program Director at the International Development Exchange.
This loan amount is very real. It's as real as the loan that you take out from a bank, from a personal loan. It is very real, and the banks intend to be paid. They feel that this agreement was made fair and square with the signing nations, and they intend to be paid. They are very, very resistant to movements like the Jubilee 2000 for complete cancellation. The payment that is being forced on the African nations is being made at the cost of food and healthcare and education to the millions of poor people in sub-Saharan Africa. The top priority is to make sure that this payment is made. And 30 to 50% of the total earnings of many of these nations has to go to making these payments. So you can imagine if what you're earning is being cut by 50% and someone were to come into your home and take the food out of your refrigerator, knowing full well your children are not going to eat. It is as real as that.
In 1997, the United Nations Development Program estimated that debt relief by the year 2000 would save the lives of 21 million children. And UNICEF estimates that 20,000 children die every day from preventable illnesses. Jokey Jeho.
When UNICEF says 20,000 children are dying in indebted country every day from preventable and curable diseases, it does not take an economist or a rocket scientist to make the link that children are dying because they lack immunization. And they lack immunization because the government does not have money to put into hospitals and into immunization programs. Children are starving because food security has been severely compromised because the government provides funding for and credit for farmers to grow coffee and tobacco and flowers and bananas, but not beans and rice or sorghum and millet and other things that are consumed locally. In many, many indebted countries, you find a phenomenon where countries are producing what they don't consume and consuming what they don't produce. And in many cases, a lot of people are simply not consuming.
Meanwhile, international lending institutions and banks are virtually sucking currency out of indebted countries. According to Sadina Sangor, co-founder of Jubilee 2000, a worldwide movement calling for international debt relief.
Let me give you an example. In Senegal, where I'm from, every Thursday at 4 p.m., all the banks close. No more transaction. I mean, for people. But they were getting all the money at 4 p.m., send it to the treasury of the country so that the country get that money together to send it to service the debt. Every Thursday, you see, you know, we're not talking about, you know, like figures on a paper. I'm telling you in real life what's going on. People die because of lack of medical necessities and attendance. Or they die because, you know, but what we often don't talk about is the emotional wound it creates in people on a daily basis, that you used to be able to guarantee your dignity by, you know, meeting your needs or being respecting a reciprocity between you and a peer or your wife or your husband. It depends on what the situation is. And then you find yourself not being able to do it, and then people who do not understand that outside there are forces that are creating this situation, they take it on you or you take it on yourself, think I'm less than what I'm supposed to be, I'm less than what a good husband is supposed to be or what a good brother is supposed to be. And then they commit suicide or you know, all sorts of... They destroy people's heart like that. You know, recently two Guinean people, I was saying, in front of the IMF, they just decided to commit that kind of suicide in front of world international opinion so that they know that the debt is ruining their life, they have no future, so they are sacrificing their lives to put the word out, and they had a letter to explain that.
But why shouldn't indebted countries have to pay off their debts, just like anyone who purchases something with a credit card is responsible for the bill?
It's a literal transposition of two different realities. You know, the debt you contract from your bank as a citizen of a country and the debt that we are talking about are very different.
Sadina Sangor.
You know, we use the same word, debt here, debt there, which is the same word, but two different meanings and two different contexts. So if they need help, it might be at that level that it's not like, you, I want to borrow this. It was compulsive lending, one. The second is we have to realize that those who are contracting those loans are not legitimate because they never consulted with the people to do so, and they never used it for the benefit of the people. So we are saying people who are not responsible of the debt should not be paying for it. The peasant should not be paying for it. The child should not, who's just newborn, should not be paying for it by not having enough milk, not having clothing, you know, health, primary health care, on that. They were never consulted. Women who live in villages and who have to you know, to work like slaves because of the scarcity of everything. They were not consulted. That's what we're saying.
Not only were they not consulted, but in some cases, the people of indebted countries never even saw the borrowed money in the first place. Nunu Kadani explains that corrupt leaders in sub-Saharan Africa actually accepted loans from the IMF and made personal deposits in Western banks.
So it's really ironic because a lot of the money that was actually given that we continue to pay huge interest rates on is not even being used. It was never used for the benefit of the African people. It went back into Swiss banks, and the African leaders who are charged with corruption, time and again we have heard that the African governments who take out these loans were basically so corrupt and they were embezzling funds and fattening their pockets. Well, the money ended up in Western banks. Everyone knows full well where the money is. The Swiss banks are not willing to release it, and none of the Western banks are willing to release it. So there's nothing secretive about it. We know where the money is. We continue to pay interest rates on money we don't even have.
Other countries have accrued debt under illegitimate or repressive governments. Take the example of South Africa, which was ruled by an apartheid government until the early 1990s. Brian Ashley is with AIDC, the Alternative Information and Development Center in South Africa.
In South Africa, it comes across in this way. People are asking, why must we, the victims of apartheid, now have to pay for our victimization? Why must we pay twice for apartheid by having now to pay this apartheid debt?
Such debts are recognized under international law as, quote, odious debts. If a debt is found to be odious, a country can be relieved of its obligation. South Africa's debt is considered to be one of the clearest examples of odious debt.
Here we're talking about odious debt. These are not legitimate debts. And in international law, there's the doctrine of odious debt. Now, that doctrine has been undermined by the existence of the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF and the World Bank. But nevertheless, this is a recognized doctrine of international law, which basically says that normally successor governments have to honor the debts of the debts of the past regime, except in the case in which those loans have been undertaken by a illegitimate regime against the interests of the people. Now, it can be no clearer than in the South African case, where South Africa and apartheid South Africa was deemed to be a crime against humanity. It was the pariah state of the 20th century. And therefore, all loans to apartheid has to be seen as odious debts, odious loans, and ought to have fallen away with the previous regime.
But the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund do not recognize the international doctrine of odious debt, and South Africa is still required to make debt payments. At the same time, other countries, such as Haiti, which has also accrued what some consider odious debt, are paying more in debt payments to so-called northern or first world countries than they receive in aid from those same countries. Cammy Chalmers, executive director of POPDA, the Haitian Advocacy Platform for Alternative Development, says that debt repayment plans essentially amount to social control mechanisms. Chalmers is translated by Marx Aristide.
Nous croyons que la question de dette là, c'est un morceau dans le système économique mondial tête en bas qui a causé papier, mais nous croyons que c'est un morceau qui est très important parce que c'est un mécanisme d'apport.
We think that the debt issue is but one part of the entire upside down world economic order. But nevertheless, we think it's a very important one because it's one of the most efficient ways that they use to keep the status quo the way it is. To illustrate this problem, it's estimated that $35 billion from the northern countries went to the southern countries in 1998. However, the outflow from the southern countries to the northern countries is $250 billion. To service the debt.
Donc c'est une hémorragie qui est absolument criminelle et qui est inacceptable, d'autant plus que nous.
It is a situation that's totally immoral and unacceptable, particularly since these debts were contracted by dictatorial regimes, which the people have absolutely no business in paying. Between 1980 and 1990, the people of Latin America have paid more in debt than they had owed in 1980, and since 1990 they owe even more now than they had owed in 1980. It's a spiral, it's a vicious cycle, and mathematically there's no way out of it. In addition, it's a criminal debt, because it means servicing this debt usually means that there's no money to put into things like education, potable water, healthcare. For example, in Haiti, the debt service, the money that Haiti uses to service the debt is twice as big as that which it uses for healthcare.
Et nous croyons que, de plus, là, nous considérons de façon historique, dans une période plus longue.
And if we look at it from a broader historical perspective and go further, during 500 years with the slaughter of the Native Americans in the Americas and the slave trade where many people were killed, and also when you consider that the richness, the wealth of the North is totally based on the super exploitation of the southern countries, it is very clear that it is the North that owes the South and not the other way around.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we'll be giving out our toll-free number at the end of this broadcast.
So how did this debt cycle start in the first place? Sedina Sangor says the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund started lending money to poor countries following the Second World War, after the two institutions were founded at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire.
There was a conference in 1945 in Bretton Woods in the United States. That conference gave birth to two giant financial institutions, such as the IMF and the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. And those institutions designed a policy for the Third World, the non-aligned movement. You have to send them money, lend them money. And when you lend them money, they will keep depending on us. So there has been a compulsive lending of money, and they had their experts, respectable gentlemen, very well dressed with suits, who were being sent to those governments as advisors and experts, and then they were convincing them to contract these loans, you know, because the money is there, take it, you know. But what they really had in mind was the return, which they were not telling these, let's say the example of African countries, because I'm from Africa. Those heads of states and were irresponsible enough to play the game, because it takes two for a tango, you know, and take the money without consulting with their people, and then use the money among themselves with their families and friends. The people never got anything. And the reason I'm telling you, take the example of former Zaire, where Mobutu was being given money by the IMF, and they knew that he was not spending it on development issues. He was spending it on his own frivolous, you know, lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. But they kept sending him the money because it allowed the multinational corporations to deal with the diamond and gold and you know, all that wealth in Zaire. So there was like a green light. Come and do what you want. Come and raid this country. I don't care.
Then, in the 1970s and 1980s, the World Bank and other lending institutions started shopping around for more borrowers, according to Soren Ambrose, policy director at the 50 Years is Enough Network.
The debts of the Third World came to be what they are through a process of aggressive loan marketing in the 1970s. That was probably the most influential part of this. The World Bank and private banks both in the 1970s were looking to lend. And they were doing this because they had a surplus of cash on hand. And so they suggested projects that countries could begin to work on, such as infrastructure projects like bridges and dams and power plants. They simply worked with government officials who were their friends, often in the finance ministries or the president or vice president of a country. And there were very few checks and balances on the kinds of loans that were being taken out. So a lot of these loans were really the product of undemocratic processes and a lack of consultation with the people of the countries that were signing up for them. Unfortunately, it is, of course, the people of those countries who end up having to pay back the loans. One of the problems here is the variable interest rates. A lot of the loans that countries took out in the 1970s, when banks were trying to aggressively market loans to third world countries, were loans that were at pretty low interest rates, 6%, 4%, something like that. In the small print, what many of the finance ministries who were taking out these loans failed to notice, and what many of the banks failed to point out, was the proviso that these loans were really variable interest rate loans, so that if the standard interest rate on the world market went up, so did the interest rate that these countries would have to pay. And, of course, what happened at the end of the 1970s is that the Federal Reserve here in the U.S., in an inflation-battling measure, started to hike the interest rates that it charged banks here. So, consequently, interest rates around the world went up. And at one point, they reached a peak of about 21% in 1981.
The World Bank and the IMF never write off or reduce their loans. When a debtor country finds itself unable to pay, the IMF comes to the rescue, offering a new loan to cover the old. These new loans come with strings attached, known as structural adjustment policies. Jokhi Jeho, who is also with the Jubilee 2000 movement, says these policies instruct a debtor government how to operate in order to make its debt payments, leading to cuts in spending on education, healthcare, road building, electricity, and sanitary water systems.
Structural adjustment programs are not really about helping people, but they're about these institutions and Western governments like the U.S. and Japan and the United Kingdom and Germany maintaining control and allowing their institutions, their governments, their multinational corporations to have carte blanche on the economies of indebted countries. And so we reject that. Jubilee 2000, especially in the Global South, has said that debt relief linked to structural adjustment is a poisoned chalice. And debt relief linked to structural adjustment, the South African Council of Churches has said, merely polishes rather than breaks the chains of debt. And we are calling for a fundamental addressing, a definitive debt cancellation idea and program, not one where countries are kept on a debt treadmill.
Cami Chalmers of POPTA adds that structural adjustment policies shift decision-making power away from indebted countries to the lending institutions themselves.
Une caractéristique essentielle politique d'ajustement structurel, c'est que yo fait d'appui.
One of the major problems with the structural adjustment programs is that they derail the economic process, whereby the people who were duly elected, those who are duly elected by the people, they no longer have true power. You have a shift of power from the duly elected representatives somewhere else.
In fact, Harvard economist Jeffrey Sachs has argued that the IMF is completely miscast as a development institution and acts as a surrogate government for many impoverished countries because of the extensive IMF conditions which must be met in order to qualify for IMF loans and debt relief. According to some estimates, for every $1 in aid given by the 29 richest countries, $3 is sent back in the form of debt repayment. Since 1984, sub-Saharan Africa has paid $167 billion to the West.